From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a conversation with the journalist who managed the investigation that uncovered the Panama Papers, which led to the resignation of two world leaders.
Later, a recent poll shows most members of the millennial generation have never seen classic films like Citizen Kane or His Girl Friday.
Even though they're dressed in 40s clothing, and they got the phones with the second receiver on there, and they got old-fashioned cars, the writing in there and the acting and the chemistry, people can enjoy it today.
One of the actors in the play Domino Heart reflects on what she's learned from it.
Instead of a new lesson, it's just a reminder of appreciating and loving those people around us and letting them know while they're here, not after they've passed, and feeling the regret of that.
And we'll hear a new tune from singer-songwriter Tiff Merritt. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. When the Panama Papers were released in 2016, the investigative report led to protesting in countries throughout the world and the resignation of two world leaders.
The piece exposed more than 200,000 offshore entities and revealed the wealthy and powerful people behind those shell corporations. More than 370 journalists around the globe worked for a year to uncover the information from the leak.
Marina Walker Guevara is the deputy director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and she managed the investigation. She sat down with Joy Powers recently to talk about her work and why this particular investigation was so important.
The Panama Papers is the largest leak of financial information, I should say, of secret financial information ever obtained by journalists. It's 11.5 million records of secretive offshore structures belonging to thousands of people around the world, including prime ministers and presidents and senators and all kinds of people of public interest. And the reason why it's so important is because the offshore world is built on secrecy. Basically, when you are in the real world where we all live, you have to put, let's say, your house, your car is in your name, right? If you own it, you really own it and you put it in your name and it's in a public record. But when you play in the offshore world, in tax havens, and sometimes those tax havens are also inside our own countries, when you play in these tax havens, you don't have to put your name on anything. So basically you can have millions of dollars, yachts and jets and bank accounts in the name of somebody else. It's called nominee directors. It's people you basically rent. They rent their name so you don't have to put your name on your money. And that way we create like a completely, like a parallel economy that basically underpins the real economy. And that's where the big deals and the big transactions and where a lot of criminality is going through these days.
Now, you've been involved with a lot of this kind of work, this investigative work on, leaked data kind of information, data-driven journalism. How did this compare to some of the previous things you've worked on?
It was a huge challenge, but we're so glad that it happened because of the secrecy of the offshore system. Basically, the only way to look behind those structures is through a leak of information. We needed, the world needed the Panama Papers to happen in order to realize really how damaging these structures are and how much criminality is involved. And as prosecutors would tell you and as journalists who have investigated this kind of crimes before, it's virtually impossible to get the information any other way. So the Panama Papers really, it showed us, I think, and it's a really important message, and especially for bad guys, that in the digital age, secrecy is really an illusion. And that information is going to continue becoming more and more available, hopefully to investigative journalists who would, looked at it through the public interest lens and really dig out the stories of public interest inside those leaks, and then go to the public record and see what information is there about those crimes. Because there's always a conversation, I say, between what is in a leak and what is in the public record.
Now, digging into it is something that I'm sure it might have been actual digging. It seems like it would be millions of, you know, documents to go through. You were managing this team. What did that process look like, going through all of these documents?
Well, we were lucky that we were working with a lot of really great technicians and developers and people who are not journalists and who really know what they are doing when it comes to big data. And basically to, you know, being able to digest all this messy leak, you know, because it doesn't come all organized and ready for journalists to take notes. We had audio files, we had formats that don't exist anymore and like huge databases, and all of that had to put like inside like these machines, processed, cleaned, and then put on a platform for journalists all over the world to access it, because our model, the ICIJ model, is that we work with local journalists in more than 80 countries, and we expect them to be able to access this information from their computers. So it was a huge technological effort, also taking into account security questions. We were putting this information on the internet, of course, in a secure manner. But you can imagine that each one of those 300 plus journalists that took part in this investigation could have been a weak link and could have compromised the whole investigation. So that's why it took a year. And we really took our time. We said, this needs to be done well, because it's the first time anybody's attempting to work on this global scale. And if we fail, then it's really bad news, not only for the world, but it's also really bad news for journalism. We're not going to be trusted again by whistleblowers. Instead, they're going to go to NGOs, or they're going to go to governments.
There were, as you mentioned, a lot of people who were caught up in this leak of information. Were you surprised by some of the people who were involved with these organizations?
I wasn't surprised so much about the billionaires or the celebrities. Like, we know they like to hide their money, and we know they don't like sometimes to pay a lot of taxes. But I was surprised about the sheer amount of politicians in this leak. And maybe I shouldn't be. Maybe it's a little bit naive on my part. But really, like, prime ministers and presidents and people, you know, Supreme Court justices, people that we have entrusted with so much in our communities, to allow themselves to, you know, swim in these muddy waters of the offshore system. And sometimes not for a lot of money, which was also kind of like interesting. It was, you know, sometimes for small amounts, just for the pure secrecy, or, you know, because they wanted to conceal or they were concerned about their public images. So that was one of our biggest surprises, an enormous amount. So more than 140 prominent politicians, including 12 world leaders. And of course, two of those prime ministers already resigned. The prime minister of Iceland as soon as the investigation broke, and then most recently the prime minister of Pakistan.
And you're a native of Argentina. How did you feel when you found President Mauricio Macri? He was wrapped in it.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And it also shows a little bit of like the challenges of our methodology. We didn't find Macri until December of 2015. And that was about 2 months after he was elected president. But we had been working before, so it's so interesting. He was a businessman before, so in that respect, it's not that surprising. What it is surprising is the way that the president handled the aftermath of the Panama Papers, and that's true for most of those prominent world leaders. They were in denial. They weren't forthcoming about even though we had so much information and we made it available to them and we went ahead of time, they really didn't handle the explanation. They didn't feel like citizens deserved that information, I guess. And that resulted in a lot of embarrassment for those for those world leaders, because people actually this time made a click and they cared. They went out on the public squares in Argentina, in Malta, in London, in Iceland, and they demanded response. They realized that those citizens realized, perhaps for the first time, that they were victims of these crimes.
The Panama Papers had a huge impact around the world. What did the impact look like here in the United States?
Well, here in the United States, it was a little bit tricky because we didn't have the big public figure, the big politician this time. And there were a lot of conspiracy theories about that, like, are you hiding the politicians? And no, we weren't hiding anybody. They weren't just there. There were a lot of very rich people, and the New York Times and McClatchy and other partners did great stories about them. And then right after the Panama Papers, there were some initiatives and push to try to make it less easy for people to create shell companies in the U.S. Unfortunately, the U.S. has pockets of tax havens. We know of Delaware, Wyoming, Nevada. Those are places where you can go and, you know, basically it takes you 10 minutes to create a company. You can put it in anybody's name. You don't have to give much information about yourself or the source of your money. So the Panama Papers sparked at least a debate and a conversation and some attempts to clamp on that kind of structures. And the last thing I would say is President Obama, who hasn't done a lot or didn't do a lot during his term to stop tax havens or secrecy here in the U.S., but he did say something very interesting after Panama Papers. He said the biggest problem with these revelations is that most of these structures are legal. And that is the big issue, that we as a society have allowed ourselves to allow these legal structures or to have these laws that protect a small group of powerful people as they go about this secret business.
Well, that might get to this kind of final question, but what do you hope is the lasting legacy of the Panama Papers? And what do you hope to see moving forward with this kind of data-driven journalism?
As a journalist, my biggest hope is that in the future we see more and more global collaborations, that we realize that the biggest stories of our time that we think are national aren't, and that the best way to tell those stories, to tackle those stories, is in a cross-border way and is through sharing our collaboration. We hope that the Panama Papers changed investigative journalism for the better, and that we are better prepared, journalists, we're better prepared to tackle the many leaks and other stories that we need to do in the future, both technologically and from a team point of view, that we trust others in other countries and that we can really create global impact through sharing and collaboration.
All right. Well, Marina, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much.
Marina Walker Guevara is the deputy director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and she managed the Panama Papers investigation. She was in Milwaukee to give the Burlai Media Ethics Lecture at Marquette University, and she spoke with Joy Powers.
A recent poll shows most millennials have never seen classic films or any black and white films of any kind. We'll find out the implications when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The New York Post not long ago polled members of the millennial generation, people born between 1982 and 2002, and asked them whether they'd seen movies widely considered to be classics. The results, to some movie buffs, were discouraging.
The poll found that less than a quarter of the millennials had watched an entire film that was made in the 1940s or 1950s, and only a third had seen one from the 1960s. And fewer than 30% had seen a black and white film. And that means no Casablanca, no Citizen Kane, or Bringing Up Baby.
Not even Goldfinger. Well, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski falls into that age bracket, but she has seen plenty of classic films. She sat down with fellow film aficionado Ross Bigley to talk about the implications of the poll.
Well, when I first read the article, I felt it was pretty accurate. I know a fair number of millennials myself, and if I'm talking with someone else and they're around or we're discussing certain things and a movie comes up, I haven't seen it. Or there's a few millennials that I know particularly who would say, oh, I'm not interested in seeing it. It's old or it's in black and white. And I sadly think that's probably an accurate depiction in that article.
Yeah, the phrase it's old and therefore it's null or, yeah. You know, yeah. Why do you think that is? Is it because it seems like a new movie released almost every week here and each one blockbuster action thing is filled with more and more, you know, CGI or effects that when it comes to viewing, quote, old-fashioned movies that are built purely upon the script and the actors that carry them, is that sense of appreciating that lost?
That could be. In my own personal opinion, I think the content that Hollywood produces now is not up to par with previous decades where you see, I think the 70s is the last really golden age of filmmaking here. The 90s had a lot of great spots in it, but you would go in the 70s and there'd be year after year and there'd be so many great films that came out. Nowadays, we are in an age where everything that people want to concentrate has to be new. Or we're talking about this now, that's past. I grew up in the 70s. I'm not going to knock this generation or how this society is now, but I always felt it was a little bit more literate society. You actually saw authors on TV discussing novels or world leaders discussing things, not saying one side against the other. There was actual discussions going on. You only had maybe three or four channels on your TV back then. I think a lot of people younger people probably can't comprehend that in this day and age, but you go home, you had the three major networks and PBS. And when a movie came on the TV at that time, because there was no video, there was no Netflix, there wasn't a Redbox, that was a big deal. Where, oh, that's on TV, let's get together as a family and watch it. PBS used to run older films quite frequently on the weekends or Friday nights. So I think that accessibility is no longer with us anymore. And I think most people are, while the technology is great with the internet, I think people are starting to be more in their bubbles where algorithms say, well, you like this, here's more like that. And people don't really venture out of their bubbles anymore to experience or find out what else is out there.
Now, before we get into the types of movies that we think make this quintessential period of movie time great, for you, what is the time frame of classic movies?
I would probably have to lump the 70s in there because most people really do consider that the last great age of Hollywood filmmaking where there was so many great films that came out in there. So maybe you would go from the 30s to the 70s. And I don't want to knock the 20s, but there's some great innovation there too, because any leap forward really happened in the 20s with D.W. Griffith's storytelling techniques and the different types of optical things they're trying, which enhance storytelling further, in my opinion. Anything older than 20 years probably could be considered a classic. It has enough time to have people reflect upon it and evaluate it or reevaluate it as well.
So for you, what makes a classic movie? I suppose not just for this time frame, but even if the standards of today's movie should be met, what makes it memorable? What makes it stand the test of time?
I think it's due to just the time it came out and released and how people became attracted to it, or something grabs an audience. I'm not a fan of the Fast and Furious films, but obviously that has a connection with an audience. I don't want to say that all classic films should be highbrow and art. There are some great lowbrow stuff, too, which can be considered a classic in the way the director handles the material and media.
Do you think actors also have a role to play in that? I mean, because they come and go. Some stand out as, you know, truly great actors of their time, quote unquote. But when I go back and watch a movie with Cary Grant or Audrey Hepburn, it's just like there's still not much comparison to other people, you know?
I agree there. I mean, I recently watched His Girl Friday. You know, I haven't watched it in maybe 4 or 5 years. And even though they're dressed in 40s clothing, and they got the phones with the second receiver on there, and they got old-fashioned cars, the writing in there and the acting and the chemistry, people can enjoy it today. Cary Grant is brilliant in it, and so is Rosalind Russell. It's probably a film that was ahead of its time when it came out because of the overlapping dialogue, the quick, fast-pacedness of it. And that probably played into how people feel that comedy should be played nowadays.
With millennials watching these films, I mean, maybe they're in college and take a film class and are exposed to some of these classic movies, but what do you think is the main obstacle? You mentioned that we have content overload and the availability of these movies being played on the regular is not as much as it was back when PBS was airing it, or if someone doesn't have Turner Classic Movies on their TV, you know, they're probably not going to be exposed to this type of thing. So, yeah, is it just in a completely different lane and people are zooming by?
I think so. I think it's accessibility, for one thing. A lot of people have cable still, but a lot of people cut the cord. And that was a great outlet for classic movies. When I was younger, AMC actually played classic movies. When I was in college, I actually went to, there was this great video store here in Milwaukee called Video Visions, and they had probably the best selection of films ever, more vast than a library. And if I wanted to watch like a Godard film, they had most of the Godard films on VHS. And that was my film education at the time. And outlets like those, video stores, are really no longer around. So a lot of kids I know turn to Netflix. And Netflix really doesn't program much beyond 1990. Nothing to the extent of what you would find in a video store or on Turner Classic Movies.
Right. And with Netflix, a lot of your time is spent on picking something to watch, because that's overload too. And I was on it the other night, and I saw a new category pop up that said movies from the 1990s. And I'm like, oh my God, have we reached that point already? You know, that it's categorizing these movies already in that time frame, you know, as something separate and distinct, or, you know, quote, old.
I think people don't realize with Netflix, they're a licensing service more so than anything. There's also a reason why they carry the certain films that they do, because studios will say, here's this. You know, this is what you're getting with this package. With the downturn in DVD and Blu-ray sales, studios aren't really releasing their big film, classic films, or library in abundant numbers as they used to. And so those films are going out of print. There's some small boutique retailers like Kino, of course, Criterion, that will release this stuff, but they don't do it in large numbers. And you don't generally see this stuff in a store either.
Right. So let's talk about some of these films. And for our listeners, you and I did compile a list of 10 classic films spanning from, you know, the 1940s into the 1960s. And we invite all our listeners to go online and fill out the survey, just because we're curious how many of you have actually seen these movies. But with some of these films, which ones do you see as the quintessential standard? So, for example, one of my favorites is Roman Holiday. It's the first film that introduced Audrey Hepburn and kind of launched her career, and she was acting alongside an already standing legend, Gregory Peck.
Yeah, yeah. I like Roman Holiday a lot. That's William Wyler, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. It's a charming film. That's a star turn. by an actress, Gregory Peck is no slouch, but it really catapulted her. You know, I think right after that she did Sabrina, or was it a year after? Or
just about a year after Sabrina, yeah.
Which, in those days, Hollywood used to package films and thought, well, she was good like this, let's make more films like that. Mm-hmm. And that really helped cement her as, like, she was like the Julie Roberts of the day.
Yeah.
Or Meg Ryan or whoever is. There's no romantic comedies anymore, are there?
Yeah, not to the standard of, you know, William Wyler-esque romantic comedy. You know, she was the darling, so to speak, the Hollywood sweetheart. And
yeah,
I think she keeps that platform on her own. You know, I don't know if anyone can really compare.
Well, I don't think I'm trying to recall, but I don't think there is a romantic comedy released so far this year. Has there been, or last year? It's a formula.
I don't think
that,
so. Yeah.
It's a formula that Hollywood kind of forgot to make.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to make a good one anymore. And then when the bad ones or mediocre ones come out, people generally don't see them. So they just say, let's not make a few for a while.
Right.
Westerns were like that. Now that Westerns are coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about yourself? Which ones do you suggest for people?
Well, anyone with a general interest in film should always see Citizen Kane or Casablanca right off the bat. Citizen Kane is considered arguably probably one of the greatest films ever made. I'm a huge Welles fan. And the innovation in Citizen Kane is just remarkable because he saw things differently than how the Hollywood system was. And you saw ceilings in the shot probably for the first time with that film. You didn't see a ceiling in the shot because that's where he had the lights.
Exactly. It's a big soundstage.
The overlapping dialogue again. He probably started it before his Go Friday. That was a couple years before. It's really a remarkable film in the terms of what he achieved at that age.
And with Casablanca, you know, we'll always have Paris or the often misquoted people who say, you know, play it again, Sam, which actually is not in the movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, Humphrey Bogart's one of my favorite actors. I love everything he's done. Even the weird horror film he did in the 30s, which he was contracted to play.
Another great actor who holds his own right is Peter O'Toole. And one of the films we picked is Lawrence of Arabia. And I think that's really the first example of a really sweeping worldwide production. You know, the shots on location in the deserts, the action. It's a war film, but just went beyond a lot of the films at the time. And even though there maybe were some other films that were long enough that they needed an intermission or, you know, two VHS tapes or something like that, I think Peter O'Toole's performance in this just really set it apart.
Oh, yeah. It came in a time when Hollywood was combating television a little bit, and the widescreen format was really utilized in that. And the images composed for a widescreen format are just incredible. Even the editing choices were always commented upon, where he blows the match out and boom, you're in the desert. The transitions that way. Anyone going to film school should watch that. Anyone wanting to be an editor should probably watch that too. It's a remarkable film. And back in those days, you would have these big epic films around 3 hours or so. And they had the curtain at the beginning, and he had an intermission. And they were long productions, and he made them seem special to help kind of combat television a little bit, too. In the sense, because television, anyone can sit at home. But it made it feel like an event going to those films.
And which other film would you recommend before we go on to some of the other questions?
Well, I love Double Identity.
So for those who are unfamiliar, what is that movie about, and who does it star with that?
Oddly enough, probably a person you would not associate in this day and age with hard-boiled film noir is Fred McMurray. Fred McMurray was a romantic comedian at the time. He wasn't really, a lot of his romantic comedies don't really stand out today. And then he segued into being a Disney contract player, doing The Absent-Minded Professor, Son of Flubber, Follow Me Boys, and then got a regular gig on TV as a father of my three sons. He only spent like a month on the set while they shot around him because he liked to do the Disney films in between. That was his bread and butter. But so Billy Wilder saw something in Fred McMurray, and he's the only director that saw this kind of like darker side to him. He plays an insurance agent, and it's a classic film noir story where he gets involved with a femme fatale, Barbara Stanwyck, and they plot a murder of her husband. And they use insurance as a way to kind of like get a payday out of it or whatever. And double indemnity is a term that is specific to an insurance clause. Edward G. Robinson's great, and I think that was his first turn as a character actor. He was doing leads before then, and he kind of didn't know if he wanted to do the film because he always saw himself as a star, but then it helped him extend his career probably longer than that. And Billy Wilder used Fred McMurray again as kind of a ruthless person in The Apartment, one of my favorite Billy Wilder films, as a philandering boss who maybe psychologically tortures a young Shirley MacLaine in there.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we encourage our listeners to check out the other movies on the list of 10 we have, because we thought it was a kind of a good introduction of the scope of various classic films, from comedy to noir to epics. But what do millennials, or, you know, anyone for that matter, have to gain through watching classic movies if they haven't already?
Well, I think our culture is our arts. Nowadays, our pop culture is our culture. The geek pop culture has taken over America. And, you know, that's why we have an abundance of superhero films and on TV, too, and festivals and conventions. So our pop culture is now the geek culture. But culture, in a sense, this is what, you know, brings people together. You can learn so much from watching a classic film in just how they were made. You're going to see great performances by actors you may never be familiar with. Like, imagine finding a book by an author that you just happened to discover and then find out that maybe he has 30 more books and you can enjoy those 30 books. These young kids, imagine when they discover Humphrey Bogart, you know, and realize, oh, wow, this guy's been in those other films, and you're finding something else to enjoy, too. Or, you know, Gregory Peck, Audrey Hepburn, you know. They're not going to be disappointed going in that area.
Well, Ross, thanks for taking the time to speak about it today.
Well, thank you.
Ross Bigley is a Wisconsin filmmaker and the organizer of the Milwaukee Short Film Festival. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can take the poll about classic films they talked about at WUWM.com.
Up next, organ donation is the subject of a play opening this weekend. We'll talk with the director, one of the actors, and the nursing supervisor of transplant services at St. Luke's when Lake Effect returns right after this. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the world of organ transplants, one person could potentially save 8 lives. Each donor has 2 lungs and 2 kidneys, and one each heart, liver, pancreas, and intestine. And when you count non-life-saving organs like the eyes or skin, even more people could be helped by a complete body donation.
Many of us have the orange donor dot on our driver's licenses, but as we'll learn in a moment, that's not quite enough to ensure your wishes are carried out. Milwaukee's Morning Star Productions tackles the subject of donation in its new production of Domino Heart, which opens this weekend at the theater at Esterbrook Church on Green Bay Avenue.
Joining me in the studio this morning are Morning Star's artistic director, Alan Atwood, actor Tirsa Ferraro, and the nursing supervisor for transplant services at St. Luke's, Adam Collio. Collio says that when theater tackles a subject like this, everyone wins.
I think it does bring awareness to people so that they understand the need and the powerful gift that is transplant. So I think when people receive an organ, it's really a second chance at life. That's why we call it such a gift and a donate life. I think the supply and demand that we have for organs for patients waiting for a transplant is at a critical level. More and more people get added to a wait list every day, and more people need an organ. But the amount of organs available for those waiting has remained stagnant. So as more people get added, the amount of organs stays the same, and supply and demand goes up. So I think just raising awareness for people to understand that donation is an important thing and that, you know, transplant is an important service that we provide, that I think that's the biggest gift that you guys give with a play like this.
This play is called Domino Heart, and obviously people think of hearts for transplants, but mm-hmm. what are some of the other organs that are in most demand?
Kidney, for sure. Kidney transplants are probably the highest volume in the country. I think as well, there's a liver transplants, pancreas transplants you can do intestine. We mentioned skin, tissue, eyes, things of that nature, but probably the three main organs are the heart, liver, and kidney that are probably the most prominent.
And one of the other things we were talking about before we turned on the microphone is that it's not enough if you are, you know, on your license to have the donor thing, that that's just the first step.
Correct. So we talked about intent versus consent. So, you know, when you look at your driver's license and you put that orange dot on your license, that's your intent to donate. That does not actually physically give consent for you to donate your organs. So you can either go to the Donate Life website to sign the consent, or you can, you know, at the time of donation, your healthcare power of attorney or next of kin or whomever's deemed that that person would have to consent for your organs to be donated.
Yeah, that was something I didn't know. I thought it was enough to mm-hmm. just put that donor sticker
right,
on your,
right.
It's like, there it
just
is.
Just your intent, you know, to donate. Right,
okay.
Right.
Alan, Morningstar Productions is putting on this play. What was it about the play and its subject matter that drew you?
Well, it's unique. It's just four different characters talking about their experience surrounding this event of someone donating, in this case, a heart, and it being transplanted from one character to another and then actually to a third. And obviously in the play, it's used as the transplant is used as a metaphor for commonality. It's very character driven. So it brings out, you know, how each of these three people, though they're very different, are also very much the same. And obviously, you know, using that metaphor again of sharing the heart.
And Tirsa, you're acting in this. What is it like to be part of that conversation?
Right. I think it's a really interesting play, and it's a very interesting character and a place to go that is beyond my current experience, but is a more common experience than you'd like to see. My own sister lost her husband in a very hard way, and it was hard for her at that critical moment of donation, even though he had his donor card, even though maybe they had discussed it, and I don't really know that, but it does bring this issue to light. And for my character, she's dealing with that right away. Right off the bat, she's dealing with the 3 days after the funeral and what happened and where it's going and all of the stuff that has to happen to make that heart go to another person and to live in another person and how she deals with that. And so for me, it's just an experience. It's just an experience as an actor. It's a difficult role, and it has a lot of, like we like to call, red meat in it.
It's very chewy.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
You kind of get into it and you're finding, I mean, you're going to real stuff very quickly.
Very fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, Adam, for the nursing staffs, you're kind of on the front lines of all of this. What are the emotions that go on amongst the medical staff that's watching, you know, people like the character that Tirsa is playing, you know, struggle with all of this?
So there's a little bit of a line that we draw in that regard, in that we, as nursing staff that take care of the recipients of these organs, we don't approach the donor families. So there's a specific organ procurement organization that we work with called the Wisconsin Donor Network that's actually based at the Blood Center of Wisconsin on 18th in Wisconsin. So they are the individuals that would approach a family that would get consent for the donation. So we don't have that interaction with donor families. There's some lines
that's on purpose.
That's on purpose. That's the ethical lines that we draw, that we wouldn't want to entice somebody or try to convince somebody to donate an organ to give to one of our patients that we know needs it. That would be a little bit of a gray ethical area. So in that regard, we are on the other side of the fence. But the roller coaster that we go through in terms of emotions of dealing with the patients that we care for, we can go from anywhere from, you know, joy and exuberance when patients receive a transplant to, you know, sorrow when they die on the wait list. You know, I think that that's the roller coaster that we go through. That's the harsh reality of what we deal with. But, you know, it's just the facts of the job.
And Alan, one of the things that is so powerful to me about this, and one of the reasons I wanted to do this interview, is this merging of art and medicine, the fact that a theatrical piece can have such a powerful impact on people, and maybe even make people think about becoming donors if they haven't. I mean, is that part of the idea of doing this, of this play?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have people from Wisconsin Donor Network there at some of the talkbacks, talking about their experiences, their personal experiences with transplants, and hopefully that will, yeah, bring more awareness.
And so what have you learned as you've been directing this play and working on this? Is there something about becoming a donor that you didn't know, that you've learned?
Well, the playwright said when he wrote it, he didn't know much about that whole issue, you know, the medical issue. Obviously, it's a work of art, so it's dealing with it, again, in a metaphorical way. But I think in the play, we learn about the human side of it. I mean, we think of, you know, we think of the logistics of transplants and some of the things we've talked about already. But this is more of the human side, the people who are receiving the heart and what it feels like to one of the characters talks about what it feels like to have a heart inside of him that he knows was beating inside of somebody else. And the gratitude that some, one of the characters is an Anglican priest. He's, the scene takes place in his hospital room with him waiting at 4 o'clock in the morning, him waiting to receive a heart. And his gratitude for the person who's donating that organ to him.
Tirsa, what about you? I mean, did you know, other than your experience with your sister and brother-in-law, has this play taught you anything?
Well, yeah, I think plays always teach us things. I love the fact that this play will incorporate the medical field with the arts. We don't always get that kind of opportunity to have an outreach like that. I think Morningstar does it quite well and often, maybe more often than other theaters. But I've learned quite a bit. I learned something every day, just learning that the intent and consent difference that I just learned just moments ago. But to touch this woman in her emotion, in her emotional life, in her decision-making life, there's so much there to investigate and discover. I don't know specifically. I think she's just, for me, is a character that I can really find out more about how someone deals with the death of their soulmate and how we ignore love and the need for love up until the point of death of somebody who's close to us physically, emotionally, spiritually maybe. But maybe we ignore how much we can show that love until they're gone. And I guess in that way, it's just a reminder, maybe instead of a new lesson, it's just a reminder of appreciating and loving those people around us and letting them know while they're here, yep, not after they've passed, and feeling the regret of that.
Yeah. Adam, are you going to come see the show?
I would love to. I have to check the dates and see when they are, but yeah. I think it would be great.
I wonder, you know, what medical personnel will take from this.
Right. Well, obviously, as Alan alluded to, there's some artistic freedom. I think that's drawn, and, you know, that's fair, but I think anytime we bring up the topic, I think it's going to be great for, you know, transplant in general, just to have awareness that that's something that people need.
Right. And that the little dot isn't enough.
Right.
Which is something we all learned today. Right. Yeah. Do we have time for a little taste of the play? Would you be willing to give us a little something?
Sure.
Set it up. Tell me where we are and what's just happened and what's about to happen.
So my character has two scenes, the immediate aftermath of his passing, and then later in the play, her dealing with that going forward and how she and her daughter are going to go forward in life. This is her coming to grips with that thing we were just talking about, not letting him know how much she loved him and not being able to get through to him in their life together, even though her whole being had been invested in him, but not really realizing that. So she says, "The truth is, there aren't many things worse than being careless with someone's heart. That is unforgivable. It's just that we've become used to it." In 10 years, he hadn't been able to work through it. So you see, maybe the argument was also a factor in the accident. Maybe, I don't know, his lack of concentration, his watery eyes, maybe the fact, the thing that led me to my affair with that boy so many years ago was the first link in the chain of events that led to Peter's death. Or maybe a deer just crossed the road at the wrong time.
That's from The Domino Heart. Tirsa Ferraro, thank you so much. Adam Calio and Alan Atwood, thank you so much for being here. I look forward to seeing the show.
Thank you for having us.
Morningstar Productions Artistic Director Alan Atwood directs, and Tirsa Ferraro stars in Domino Heart. Adam Calio is the Nursing Supervisor for Transplant Services at St. Luke's Medical Center.
Domino Heart opens this weekend at the Theater at Estabrook Church on Green Bay Avenue in Milwaukee, and it runs through early October. You can find out more information about both the show and about organ donation at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we'll have an in-studio performance from singer-songwriter Tift Merritt. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. We have a few minutes on today's show to listen in on a recent session from the Lake Effect Performance Studio.
We first spoke with singer-songwriter Tift Merritt on this show 10 years ago. She's lived through a lot over the last decade, some difficult times and some joyous ones, like becoming a mom just over a year ago. We'll hear a full interview with her in the coming days, but here is a sample, a song she played for us called Wait For Me.
Driving west, gonna find something I ain't found yet. I hope it's there, hope it ain't left. Wait for me, wait for me. Echo sings, let me down, but that's back behind me now. Blurry towns are my back seat. Wait for me, wait for me. You gotta do right by your lady, and you gotta do right by your dream. Wanna do right by my baby, and my baby wanna do right by me. Yeah, my baby wanna do right by me. And out, I don't need the words. I know what it's about. My own marker, keep my beat singing. Wait, wait for me. Yeah. Above her knees she sings, wait, wait for me. You gotta do right by your baby, and you gotta do right by your dreams. I wanna do right by my baby, and my baby wanna do right by me. Oh, my baby wanna do right by me. Oh, my baby wanna do right by me. Oh, wait for me.
Singer-songwriter Tift Merritt playing Wait For Me in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. It's on her latest album, which is called Stitch of the World, and we'll hear more songs and the interview in days to come. That wraps up Monday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock. Fresh air comes your way next.